Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 5. South Dakota seemed like the perfect place to unplug. But I ended up connecting to the world around me. A world where each sunset was painted. Where I felt adventures pulse with every step. And where cold water trickling, pine swaying, and grunting bison became my favorite soundtracks. I just wish I didn't have to leave. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.
Hi, this is David Frangioni, CEO and publisher of Modern Drummer Magazine. So excited about our new podcast, the Modern Drummer Podcast. This weekly podcast will bring Modern Drummer to life. Sit back and enjoy fresh, fun, and insightful conversations with today's top drummers, producers, musicians, beat makers, and craftsmen. Whether you're a professional, a hobbyist, drummer, musician, programmer, producer, or just love music, this show is for you. Every other week, the Modern Drummer Podcast will feature world-renowned producer, songwriter, and drummer, Narda Michael Walden. Narda Michael Walden's Upbeat is featured exclusively on the Modern Drummer Podcast.
You mean
Oh, the guy? Oh, yeah, Will.
I missed so much. Hey, beautiful dude.
A lot of folks don't know you play bass on this jam.
Take me to the garden.
He's the man on his first album, my bro. Thank you.
Take me to the garden.
Will, I love you so much, man. I love you so much, you the cat, man.
Anyway. You are such an understated musician's musician that I forget that you have piano chops, and it makes me mad because I'm so jealous. You know, when you were mapping out these tunes for us, you weren't sitting there showing off your piano chops. You had written all that stuff on piano, right?
I write on piano, but I don't write it out. I just communicate it, yeah.
But it's just great. It's just great. I mean, but, you know, I think that what you probably came to realize in the end, and this is always the way I've always thought, that the great communicators are the drum and the voice.
Wow.
Right? Whew. Since way back, since smoke signal time.
You know, yes, brother. Smoke signal. So are
those
you
the great communicators?
Are you in Paris?
No, but we're in the south of France.
You're in south of France? Yeah. How do you feel? I mean, how's it feel there?
Well, first of all, bottom line is we're grateful to be alive.
Yeah.
These days, you know, yes. And we're grateful to be out of wildfire zones, and we feel for you, and we know what you've been through, and you know, it's where that's concerned.
Yes.
So it's a lot of gratitude these days,
right?
Going around.
That's right.
You know, and it's based on some real basic stuff, being alive.
That's right.
And what a huge gift, and what a thing that is.
Yes, brother. Yeah. Yes.
So happy papa?
I am. I have a 6-year-old named Kelly. I have a 5-year-old named Kayla, and I have a 2-year-old boy named Michael who's beat on the damn drums.
All right. So we know what's happening. We can see a pattern developing in your home, man.
Yeah.
Dancing, singing, playing, the whole thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's go back to Florida, you know, to your early upbringing. Can you tell us about what it was like being raised in Florida and what happened to you as a kid to make you who you are now? Just start there if you don't mind.
Well, let me just tell you really straight ahead and super frank and honest about my beginnings. I'm from Texas.
Okay.
And I started there until I was 11.
Okay.
And while we were there, my parents were probably the oddest people in the town of Huntsville, Texas.
Okay.
Because Huntsville, Texas, being a, I don't even know how to describe it. Because, you know, it's funny because you go between having learned perspective versus what felt like home and normal at the time. And now you realize how awful and screwed up the world is and was then. It was very segregated. There were no dark-skinned people in any of my classes that I remember meeting ever.
Okay.
You know, and it was very like, you know, here's the water fountain for you people, and here's the water fountain for you people, that kind of thing. It was very much like that. And it's a prison town on top of it. It's the State Department of Corrections is in that town. Okay, so that's like the backdrop of what my dad and mom were up to. They were jazzers.
Oh,
dad was a bebop piano player who had gone from being a trumpet player, but because of tuberculosis had to switch over. And you know, it's a funny thing, it's like there's so much history, but he was in the Fourth Army Band, and he was very close with a guy named Vito Farinelli, who we know as Vic Damone.
Oh yeah, of course.
And that's my godfather.
Okay. He right? married that beautiful black lady,
Diane Carroll.
Oof.
Oh, stunning.
Yeah.
Ridiculously beautiful.
Yeah.
So now my parents, in spite of everybody around us in that town, were totally into jazz, and they didn't think like everybody else was thinking in that town. You know, so it's interesting that my father landed in that town because he was head of the music department in the other institution of that town besides the prison, which was Sam Houston State Teachers College.
Okay.
You know. And he did such a great job that the University of Miami tapped him and said, hey, man, we love what you did with that school. Can you do that for the University of Miami? Wow. So he went down and built a faculty and the whole thing. And that's why we ended up in Florida.
Okay. See, so, I never knew the Texas hookup.
Yeah. My house was full of jazz the entire time and right. still would be if my parents were alive. Now, you know, now it's a little more varied. Because we love jazz as much as we ever did, but we also, you and I, have stretched out into all kinds of areas of music.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
So then when you went to Florida, was that a big change for you then?
It was a really big change. We were like the Beverly Hillbillies, you know? We ain't never seen no palm trees before.
We need a palm tree.
To Miami and what? It was bizarre, man. Huh?
Yeah.
Coconuts. Count me in. Okay. It was like that.
Right. So then, okay, tell me about your schooling. Were you early on a bass player? Were you early on starting to play the bass and carrying on?
I was a drummer for a good while. But since we were so young, you remember that the bass guitar back in 1964, 65 was a very still young instrument. Right. And
yeah.
So kids my age, 11, they didn't know from bass. They were thinking guitars, drums, tennis racket, guitar, drums, broomstick, guitar. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
They were just going through the motions. But the idea of what the function of a bass was a little sophisticated for 11-year-old brains. But having put it together a little band, we knew. Oh, Sandrine's here.
Oh, hi.
Hey, Sandrine.
Hi, Dada.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful. Good to see you, honey.
I just wanted to make sure that everything was good.
Oh.
Okay. Have fun.
Love you so much and love your
Thank
artwork.
You.
I want the whole world to know to support your great photographs and deeply romantic work.
Thank you.
Deeply romantic.
Thank you. It's great to see you. You look fantastic.
Yeah, good to see you. Oh, I love you too. You look great. Okay.
All right. I let you get back to
All right,
to
baby. Cool. You did. Anyway, so we were doing the Florida thing and you know, the excitement of the Beatles was kicking everybody in the butt. You know, you gotta play music. This is how it's gonna work out. You're gonna play some music, girls are gonna scream, and you're gonna be happy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so everybody was gravitating towards trying to see if they had enough talent to do music. So should we try a band? So I had a drum kit that my dad had gotten me, And I was really excited to put together myself and a couple of other guys. We got our first gig making $6 a piece at a Catholic youth organization, outdoor gig at Matheson Hammock Park in Coral Gables or Miami, Florida. Mm-hmm. After a while, it got to be like, well, you know, we got this thing happening. Wouldn't it be more fun to sound a little bit more professional and get a bass player? But there was nobody our age doing that. So I said, look, I'll just switch over to play bass and we'll get another guy to do drums. Big mistake. I was the lead singer in that band. And it was really hard to play patterns, you know what I mean? As opposed to just a solid straight straight time and still deliver a lyric. So that was a big wake-up call.
Right.
But it was too late to go back because we, our drummer that we had gotten, got us, his dad got us our first gig. So we couldn't kick him out.
Okay, great.
So great. I stuck with
it. So it's really good you learned your independency to be able to sing and play early on. Because that's what your whole life is doing now, playing and singing.
Listen, every time you, for me, every time I learn a new piece of music as a bass player and singer, I have, it's like going back to square one each time. Because you gotta learn like this part, so it becomes second nature, mm-hmm. so you can deliver the message. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I want to say for our listeners out here. I've had the great pleasure of playing at least 10, 11, 12, if not 13 shows with you at Carnegie Hall and recently at the Beacon Theater for the Rainforest shows, just to start there. And you always give me a sense of like solidarity. You always give me a sense of like, I'm gonna sound really good because you're so good. And now I'm realizing, because you're a drummer too, is why you're also got that innate hookup in the rhythm pocket. Because no matter what I do, you're right there with me. And I want people to know that about you. I mean, we do know that, but I want to say that to you. You make me feel good. You make me look good having you there. And I think that's part of what you're talking about, man. Coming from the drums, learning how to do what you do and love it so deeply. There's a passion that just burns about you. We love. Anything you want to say about that?
Well, I think it all goes back to those beginning years before I even knew what music was. And and my parents were blasting Miles and great jazz through their sound system at home for their parties and stuff. Because the first sound I ever remember hearing is Miles's muted, you know, Harmon mute. And the band that was behind them was always the best guys. And no matter what kind of music we're talking about, as far as it's music with a groove, and that's most of the music that I love and most of the music that we both are involved in always, right, is groove-based music, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And I think that I got a sense of what a good groove feels like in your body from before I even knew what I was doing, mm-hmm. you know? And I think if a kid has a jazz background especially, they can really get a sense of not only what a great groove is supposed to feel like, mm-hmm. but also the sense of what interplay is all about. Ensemble playing, you know? Because right. that's what's happening inside jazz, you know, all that improv and all that stuff and people reacting, and but with the solid sense of where one is all the time. Mm-hmm. I think that can filter over into like every kind of music.
Okay, I'm gonna push you a little bit more, Will. Your childlike spirit always comes through. Speak about your childlike spirit. You're not an old man. You're a young cat.
I don't know what it
young,
is.
Eternally young, man.
All I can say is, and I've always felt this way about the lowliest gigs, you know, if there is such a thing, some people say, oh, this is a crap gig. I'm getting out of here. You know, to me, it's always a great gig because I feel like if I'm playing music, this is the place to be. I don't know what that is, but that feels like that to me every time. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that, and when I say those situations, I'm always thinking about playing with other people. And I think that there's something really spiritually whole about playing and communicating with other humans. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
In a way, that's kind of my religion, is that connection.
I came to New York one time to do something and just called you spontaneously. And you said, well, come on down tonight. I'm going to be playing at this club with Chris Parker. So I came in there and there you were, man, just like on fire in this club with Chris Parker. doing a Brecker Brothers, just rocking this club. It's like, damn, this guy loves music. You just love music, man.
You know what that is.
I do know, but I don't want to hear you talk about it because people don't understand. Yeah, we love music. No. This cat, you will go to all those shows. You will play all those shows. You look at your discography, all things you played on, and you show up for. You are disciplined, bro. You are very.
I'm a hoe when it comes to music.
I don't want to say it.
That's all there is to it. Give me a gig. No, it's funny, man. If I'm not on a gig, it's like, why am I not on that gig? It's like that. It is. I should be on that gig.
Yeah, yeah. Now, anyway. did you meet Hiram Bullock in Florida?
Or I did accidentally because I guess, no matter what we're talking about, it's always, you can't plan these things. But I walked into a club one night. I came down from New York on a little visit. And my sisters had been freaks about Phyllis Hyman. Yes. They kept telling me, Phyllis this, Phyllis that, we're gonna go down the Checkmate Lounge, she's playing tonight, we're gonna be there, we're gonna catch every set, every note, and they come back high as a kite. Mm-hmm. So I've been hearing about Phyllis for a while. Well, I'm up here in New York, a lot of things were happening in Florida after I left. You came on the scene down there, people started talking about, oh man, you gotta check this Michael Walden guy out, Jocko. That was right after I left. People, Jocko, there was just in the air. Jocko, what about Jocko? What is that? Mm-hmm. I missed it because I left right before he came on the scene. But Phyllis was another thing that was happening after I got up to New York that cats were really talking about. Really, the buzz was happening. So I had to go check it out. So I'll go down to this, I think it was the Doral Hotel, Miami Beach. And they were doing a show, her show, and the band was like, I think Frank Gravis, Hiram, maybe Bill Bowker and Clifford Carter.
Yes, my cats.
That was the band. Mm-hmm. In fact, all those guys, just about all those guys came up to New York with Phyllis and stayed. That's why they're in New York, because mm-hmm. she wanted to go to New York and they were her band. So they're going to New York and they stayed. So that was, I'm in the audience and I'm watching these guys and they asked me to sit in that night, which was a blast. Excuse me.
Yeah.
Being a guy from radio, doing a lot of radio, I hit the mute button.
Okay.
Did you hear that?
I did.
Oh, you did?
No, I mean, I heard you,
Oh.
Take it away. Yeah.
So we just had a big cheesy French meal. Okay. Anyway, so the guys were on fire. They were burning, Phyllis already is just like the huge star that she was. She was just on, she was killing the music, so sophisticated, had all the R&B and jazz chops you could ever want and a gorgeous sound behind it, just driving it. And her spirit was unbelievable too. Yeah. So there was this incredible band, and that was the first time I got a chance to hear Hiram Bullock play. Okay. And it was pretty unbelievable. It was a real wake-up call. And then when he finally came to New York, it's like, wow, maybe I can get a chance to play with this guy once in a while, And sure enough, he joined the Brecker Brothers. He came in on the Brecker Brothers band.
Mm-hmm. Damn. So there was a, because you guys, I always think of you as soul connection with Hiram, a soul fire with Hiram.
Totally.
Yeah.
There was a total connection there. And, yeah. I always tried to get him to, guys are funny. Guys are like too embarrassed to say I love you, right? And there was a love there.
I love you, Will. I have to say that, man.
Okay. Most guys, I should say. Okay. Anyway, okay. Hey, how about those Niners? Yeah. But anyway, that's like heterosexual men making love. Hey, did you catch that field goal? Anyway.
Yeah.
So. Hiram and I always had this love, and he was so funny about it. I once kind of cornered him and I said, hey man, play with every musician in the world just about, but there's something that happens when I play with you. What do you think that is? You know, I'm kind of fishing for him to say, I love you, right, in a way. Instead, he says, well, because people like to see two big guys up there. That's what he said. So that's how he dealt with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, two big guys.
I still don't know what it was that made us click, but, you know, it's there was love in there somewhere.
Yeah, okay. Well, let me go to this side. The first time I actually hear you really get down, and I go, ooh, it's you and Billy Cobham with Dreams.
Mm.
Damn. It was like a new height. You set a new standard.
That's why I was in New York. Because of Dreams.
Speak about it. Go ahead.
Okay, so I'm taking courses at University of Miami. I'm in the big band. I'm in the A band. Just beginning to play bass in school because I had gotten talked into majoring on bass by a guy who was the assistant dean. Even my father was the dean, and the assistant dean, Ted Krieger, said, look, man, I've been checking out your playing, and I think you should major on bass. I was messing. I didn't know what I was doing. I came in as a French horn major. And it was just my grades were really bad. And he could see that I was flunking. And he was trying to help me out. He said, why don't you major on bass? I said, you can do that? You know, I didn't know you could even do that. Because bass, as we were saying, was a young instrument still. And it was kind of a new concept because the bass teachers everywhere were legitimate upright guys and all that stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. So because I was going to college and studying jazz in the daytime, and six nights a week, six sets a night, I was playing in clubs, rock and roll, top 40 type stuff. Okay. And I was into it. I loved it all. I still do. I love commercial music. I love top 40. I love jazz. I love all this stuff. I love when rock guys think I'm a jazz guy. I love when the jazz guys say, oh, he's a rocker. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I love that because it's like, yeah, whatever, you know. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And so the sort of split lifestyle I was having was jazz in the day, rocking at night kind of thing, right? And then these bands were coming out on Columbia Records, Chicago, Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And there was this one particular band that was super interesting to me, and that was Dreams. Because they had Mike Brecker, Randy Brecker. Yeah, they had Billy Cobham.
Yeah, my God.
I mean, these guys were from Neptune. Oh, you know, yes. What the heck? What is this music? You know, I couldn't get enough of it. Mm-hmm. And likewise, the people that surrounded me were just as into it as I was. So I thought that they were the next biggest band. I thought they were the next Beatles, basically, you know, because what could be bigger? These guys were all wearing out copies of this Dreams album on our stereo systems. You know, come over, excuse to get together, you know, let's listen to Dreams on my new turntable, blah, you know, all that kind of stuff. And we were eating it up. We were wearing out copies of that first album. Because nobody had ever heard anything like it, you know. And surrealistically, one day I'm in school, I'm taking this big band class or whatever you want to call it, the big band, we're rehearsing. And somebody slaps a piece of paper on top of my bass amp that says, call Randy Brecker, 212, blah, blah, blah. And it was so out of context, I couldn't remember why I'd heard that name, Randy Brecker. Right. What's 212? That's a New York area code, New York City area code. And when it dawned on me who it was, I got to the phone as fast as I could. I called up. His girlfriend answered the phone. She said, yeah, they want to audition you for Dreams. And I'm like, what? Mm-hmm. That can't be possible. You know, mm-hmm. It's just too surreal. Turns out there had been a guy that came down to guest lecture at our arranging class. And he went back up and told the Breckers, who at the time were, he knew they were looking for a new bass player because they had fired the original guy and Chuck Rainey was the current guy, but he was about to leave. Okay. Thank God I'd never heard of Chuck Rainey.
Exactly.
If I had,
yeah,
I would have said, no, man, you got the wrong guy. Hung up the phone on him. But luckily I was in the clear. Ignorance is bliss. I go up and they put music in front of me at the audition. And this was wild. And I walked into this room and there's cases on either side of the room. Miles Davis, Santana, Johnny Winter. I'm like, oh God, what kind of a surreal world have I entered here? You know, this is a rehearsal place where everybody worked on their music. And this is where Dreams was auditioning me. And I walk in the room, they put a big bunch of music in front of me. I said, guys, I'm not sure if I'm gonna need this music. Why don't you just count it off and see what happens? And that's when they saw that I knew their music backwards and forward.
Wow. So
you're our guy.
You know? Exactly. You loved it. You knew it. You're in.
That was my main focus for the longest time. You know, what are the chances of them finding me when they needed somebody? So that was an unbelievable thing that, you know, once that happened, I went to New York. I never looked back for a second.
What was it like playing with Billy Cobham?
Are you kidding?
I'm asking you because I want you to tell all these drummers out here, you know.
The first word that comes to my mind is confidence. In fact, Billy was so easy to follow because he laid it down in a way that you couldn't, all arguments were off, you know. He just said, this is it. And you said, let's go.
Right.
Right. So when he laid it down, what he did for Dreams was he was such the clock for that band that he set up like everything that was about to happen. That band had a lot of, it had songs, but it also had huge, long improvisational sections in it, you know? And he would be the guy that would let you know when to change gears. Here we're about to go into a thing. And now we're in the next channel. You know, we just changed channels on the TV set, right? We just went to the next chapter of this song. And he was the guy that was setting all this up on the live gigs. So when he left to go do Mahavishnu, we ended up auditioning, I think, 86 guys, maybe. It was grueling.
Ooh.
And we hated everybody. We hated Steve Gadd. Mm-hmm, we hated Rick Marotta. You know, we didn't hate him, but you know.
Mm-hmm, yeah, I got you.
But they just weren't Billy. Mm-hmm. So after a while, the band ended up just folding. And I said, all right, that's it. I'm gonna go back to Miami where I'll be king of everything. I've been to New York and I've played with Dreams. And two friends said, oh no, you're not leaving New York. You're gonna stay here at our house. We're gonna get you some work. I'm like, you're right. Really? Okay. And I think they got me some, I think I was a terrible house guest because they got me work really fast.
Wow, man.
You know, and next thing I know, I was like a studio guy. Like, how do you do that?
I want to speak to the people who don't really understand, Will, how intense this is, what you're speaking about. You know, we always say like that Frank Sinatra song, if I can make it in New York, I can make it anywhere. But it really is true. New York's intensity, if the rest of the world revolves at this tempo, at this speed, that New York revolves at this speed. So for you to speak about making it in New York, like Frank Sinatra, I can make it anywhere, you had to jump in and stay at this revolution. You've done this for like many, many years now, surviving and keeping up a level of perfection almost in New York City. I mean, you know, I take my hat off to you, Will.
It is like a concentrated, every day is like a concentration of days in a row, in one day, kind of. Mm-hmm. It's like you're taking the Tropicana out of the freezer and you're not mixing it with any water. You're just drinking it straight right out of the frozen can, right?
Right.
And it feels like that whenever you get off a plane and you're getting into your car to get in toward the city, you start to feel that energy like you're hopping on a ride that's already in motion. Now once you're on the ride, you feel the energy. And now that's what New York feels like.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful.
It's not laid back. Mm-hmm.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
What else was cool?
Yeah, bro.
About New York that I think is unique to that town, which maybe Nashville, you could say Nashville has it, but all of those studios were like right kind of next door to each other. Like in Midtown, they were like really close. So it'd be really easy to take a session 10 to 1, then you could take a 1. You could chance it and take a 1 o'clock and you'd probably be on time.
Wow, cool.
Basically, you just had to walk out the door, go to the next building. LA is not like that. No. LA is like drive. You gotta, you know, but it's also another kind of wonderfulness because you've landed at the studio and you can really get inside the music because you're committing. You're there. You know, you're there. We're going to call it. We're going to get lunch brought in. We're here to stay for a while.
You know? I have to be selfish to ask you a question about any memories you have of making the album Garden Love Light with Tommy Dowd producing, Raymond Gomez at guitar, David Sanchez keyboards, Jeff Beck came to play, Carlos Santana came to play, Mike Gibbs with strings. Any memory of that 1976?
It was kind of like this, you know. It was kind of like, wow, these cats. I'm surrounded by a guy who I really want to make a good impression on, and that would be you. And you were just killing on the drums. You'd written these songs and you were so much fun to play with. And I just wanted to do a good job. And I wanted to try to rise to the occasion because there was Ray Gomez, you know, and you had Jeff Beck and Carlos on the record and the legend of legends, Tommy Dowd, behind the board.
Yeah.
You know, and this guy was such a treat to be with. He was a great guy. I mean, he was, with all his brilliance, he loved hanging. He loved being around guys and he loved what the music, you know, he served the music, you know. That was my impression anyway. I'm assuming you enjoyed your time
with him. Oh, very much so. And I learned so much, you know, and he would just be a teacher. He was big on compression, teaching us about compression. He was big on saying, Ray Charles would say, don't use your eyes. You know, just, you know, close your eyes and use your ears. Mm. And then adjust with your compression by using your ears, not your eyes. In other words, people get caught up looking at meters too much. You wanted to know, no, shut all that off. Just use your ears like Ray Charles. So, you know, like that. Also, I want to say one more thing about the memory of that album. There's a middle section of a song called Saint and the Rascal with Jeff Beck. And then you hit this pedal, which I had never heard before, where you go, that kind of a sound. I was like, damn, what are you doing? That was new. You take it for granted. But to people like me, we were like, who is this cat? And that's why I love you, because you come with these surprises, man. I mean, you're like this funk, right? But then it's ultra funk. You got up into some ultra funk.
I was fascinated by sounds, you know.
Yeah.
And the guitar players had it. They had all this cool stuff, you know. They had like fuzz tones and things, you know, to mess up with their sound. And I really wanted to not be limited to just my basic bass sound. I wanted to see where it could go. So I was really lucky. I started to get a name for myself as being a guy who was into sounds and stuff. And you know the Electro Harmonics Company?
Yes, I do.
They made a record demonstrating a lot of their flangers and pedals and things way back when. They actually made a vinyl record demonstrating their sounds, and I got to really have some fun. They'd let me plug into anything I wanted to, and I was on the record, and you know, I helped them promote this huge line of pedals that they make and still do, and they still make great and even better stuff these days. And, you know, I started to be known as that guy a little bit because I loved everything about that, changing it up and see what a groove would feel like with this sound, see what a groove would feel like with that sound, you know. And also, like you said, a place to go in the music. If you're running out of notes and ideas, just hit the pedal, see what happens, you know. That's honestly what was happening. I was trying to bring something and I didn't have like a million chops, you know. I was just like, well, let me put some sound thing in. Mm-hmm.
Beautiful.
And I remember one time I was living in my little apartment, and Willie Weeks had heard about this bass player that was into pedals and stuff. So he wanted to come over and try everything. Right. And I had a kit in there, and we jammed for hours. I just played a groove, and he just went nuts on all the pedals. You know, I don't know if he never really took to it, though. Okay. You know, he was curious, but it didn't do for him what it did for me, to me.
So because we got drummers who are watching us, Will, any advice you want to give to any drummers out in the world? You played with the best of the best. You worked with the best of the best and at a high level. I mean, even, you know, you think about the early David Letterman shows with Stevie Jordan and all that stuff that you've done. I mean, it's incredible. Anything you want to say to drummers at this time in the world?
The only thing I can think of is you know, it's funny. Everybody has such a unique personality. Everybody. Everybody alive. So if you sit down in a kit and you sound like you, that's a really good thing. You know, sure you idolize Narda, sure you idolize Billy, sure you idolize Ringo, or you idolize Tommy Lee, or whoever you like. And, you know, yes, emulate them and have fun being, you know, in their shoes for a minute, but get out of those shoes and get into your own shoes, because, you know what I used to love doing is sitting with a set of headphones on in my loft. I had a soundproof room and I could play any night, any time of day or night. I built it that way because I really had this urge to want to do that. And I put the phones on and I put on some Earth, Wind and Fire.
Okay.
And I would just play along, man. And it was nothing more satisfying in life than playing along with Maurice's tracks.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
Oh, it was so good.
Yes. Yes.
That's a fun thing to do if you want to just have fun. Just yes. Do that. Put on some phones and rock it out.
But then okay, now, now let's go over here. Let's go over to now. You have a band, the Fab Four, and you love playing McCartney and Beatle music and keeping it really, really at a high level. So speak about that just for a second so we understand your love of Paul McCartney, your love of Beatles, and why you do that.
Well, it's funny because I really got my first ass kicking into music by the Beatles. No doubt about it. I give them credit. In fact, every session I ever did in the studio, the phrase in my mind would come up, what would the Beatles do here? You know, when I needed some kind of inspiration, when I needed a little bit of an idea or something, it was always something I could refer to. So, you know, at one point back in Texas when the Beatles first came out, I had a girlfriend and she saw how infatuated I was. And at one point she said the phrase, is it me or the Beatles?
Oh.
So you can see where that went. Sorry, but it was the Beatles. Anyway, so the Beatles, you know, still kicking my butt. Still, when you go to those records, you still listen and hear new stuff because there's just layers of stuff going on, layers of, like, you know, okay, so now you got that lyric that you thought was this lyric and it turned out to be that other lyric. And now you hear this part that you thought was made up of part of element A and B, but it was really made up of element C. And it's like, oh God, how can, you know, and then you start to really enjoy the subtleties of Ringo's playing.
Right.
Ringo, who very much like what Rocco did for Tower of Power, defined their sound, you know what I mean? Very much like what James Jamerson did for Motown, just defined every song with a unique part with it. He found something to bring, and he did it all day long, you know? And Ringo is the epitome of all that stuff, I think, because if he's got these two or three, however you look at it, songwriters that he's basically servicing all day long in the studio.
That's right.
Take after take after take after take after take. Mm-hmm. And anyone could be the take. And it's not him that's causing it to not be the take. He's always there bringing it. And he's always not only bringing, he's bringing something that he's kind of designed for each song. He's bringing a part that's going to take come together. You know, he's just bringing something that he didn't play on any other song. Let your mind relax and float downstream. You know, just you name it, any song. He will play something that's not the obvious thing most of the time. And he's bringing a thing that defines that record. And he's doing it 27, 107 takes in a row. with great humor, patience, creativity, and swagger. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. You know about that swagger that he has.
Thank you, bro.
His groove is always a little swing in there. He was a Cozy Cole fan. He was a, he came from jazz, like a lot of like the guys that invented, you know, Motown, the guys that brought, you know, came into the studio after doing their jazz gigs the night before and created Motown.
Yes.
You know, a lot of the original.
Do you know the story, man? I want to share one thing with you because I worked with Jeff Emmerich and George Martin on Apocalypse, right? And Jeff Emmerich told me, he said, they tried so hard to match the same bottom end sound of the Motown records out of Detroit with the UK Beatles records. And he said it drove him almost crazy that he couldn't get that same bottom that he was looking for, that he had perceived out of the Motown sound for the Beatles thing. Then he started talking about, he ended up saying, maybe it was because the currency was different, that we just couldn't get it. That was where he was coming from.
I've read that. I've read stuff like that.
Okay.
There's a whole book by Howard Massey about the British recording studios, and he gets into that. He really gets deep into that. He's also the guy who brought us the Jeff Emmerich Here, There, and Everywhere book. He got Jeff Emmerich to spill the beans about everything, and that's why that book exists, you know. Also, he was the first guy to get, he opened up Jeff when he did that book called Behind the Glass, I think, where he interviewed like a whole bunch of producers and engineers and stuff. George Martin, Arif, you know, a lot of guys.
Yes.
And Jeff was one of the guys, and he told a few secrets about how he, in his attempts to reach that place that they were all digging coming from Motown, you know, that's when he tried putting a speaker in front of the bass amp to record it with, and, you know, certain distance, put the C12 up and put certain distance from the speaker, from the bass amp in the studio. And they really got experimental trying to get there. And their biggest challenge, I think, was trying to get all that bottom end on a 45.
Right.
You know, that was a tough one. That's why the fatter the groove, the fatter the sound, you know, on those vinyl records.
I used to watch Arif Martin in the hallways of Atlantic go back and forth to the mastering room, you know, almost like he was mixing in the mastering room, trying to do just that, put more of that sound he was looking for in the groove. And almost like he was mixing because he would just keep fiddling with it.
Arif. Looking for that sweet spot, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, brother, I want to come over to some of the things that I want to ask you about, because you've touched so much stuff, bro. You're a music director, I know, for the Letterman Show and so many things you've done. Anything you want to speak about that you love in being a music director? Anything you want to say about that?
I think the thing that always surprises me every time is how much people are willing to bring it and how generous everybody is with what they, you know, they want it. They want to serve the music the way you do. So they want to make it easy for you. And for me, what I've done to make it easy for them is I do so much homework that my goal is that when the artist comes in, you know, they're coming into a room full of people they've never played with before, you know, and they're used to their own bands half the time, and they're used to being in control. But now they're coming in to sing one or two songs, right?
Right.
So what's our job as musical director?
Yeah.
It's to make a bed so that they come in and they lie in that bed, and that's just, they feel so good. They can't believe it. They look around, they go, oh my God, you guys just nailed it, you know?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
that's the happiest
exactly
thing.
Right.
The best phrase you can hear, right?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay.
Okay, beautiful. What about Love Rocks? Tell us what Love Rocks is.
Okay, Love Rocks is a gorgeous concert that's put on every year to raise money for God's Love We Deliver. And God's Love We Deliver is a miraculous organization that started back in the beginning of the AIDS crisis, where they could see that people didn't really have the strength and the wherewithal to feed themselves, because it was just too stressful and too taxing on their bodies to have this horrible disease. Yeah. And out of the kindness of somebody's heart, they began this really gorgeous organization where they bring people who are shut-ins in their, like people that can't leave their homes, not only food, but custom made food, the food that they love or the food that they need for their particular ailment that they have. You know, this has gone way beyond AIDS into people who are stricken at home with all kinds of things, you know. And not only do they take care of the patient, but they take care of the patient's family also. They feed them because those people are also completely stressed with taking care of their loved one, you know, in a way that they can't, they're neglecting themselves half the time. You know what I mean? That's right. Such a typical syndrome that happens when a loving family member or friend is taking care of somebody else. They begin to ignore their own, you know, selves. So they get taken care of in this process, and it's super generous. They're doing like, I can't remember how many thousands of meals a day. Custom. They have like 10,000 volunteers driving around, getting this food to these people. I've been to the kitchen, and it's just a wonder how much food they're putting out, and with love, and they love doing it, you know. So it takes a lot of resources to get this happening. So this fundraiser called Love Rocks is one of the many ways they're able to stay alive. And a good friend of mine, Greg Williamson, along with John Varvatos, are the two main producers, and Nicole Rector now has signed on as the third big, you know, partner in the production part of this concert.
I mean, the names are incredible who we've worked with there, with Robert Penn, David Matthews and Hart, Keith Richards, and Jackson Brown, Mavis, Joe Walsh, and C.C. Winans, and Michael McDonald, the Blind Boys, Ziggy Marley. I got to read these people. Valerie Simpson, the great, Billy Gibbons, and Sam Moore, whose birthday is today.
Aaron. That's right, 85.
Yeah, Cyndi Lauper, Black Crowes, Gary Clark Jr., and Leon Bridges, and Mark Cohen. So many folks have come to really bring aid to this, so it's wonderful. Thank you for that.
Some of these people have come multiple times, you know, and they love doing it. Jackson's been there like three times. Mm-hmm. Bill Murray shows up and brings the house down. He's so funny, always amazing. Amazing. Whoopi Goldberg, you know, Martin Short. One night, Martin Short, Chevy Chase, Paul Schaefer, and Bill Murray all get up and did a number. And it was just totally impromptu, and it was sick. And the place raised so much money because Bill Murray goes out in the audience and picks people's pockets to get some more money. God. He really is aggressive about this.
Okay.
He loves it.
Okay. Well, brother, we're going to wrap it up. I'm going to ask you for any closing word of inspiration you want to give us. This is Modern Drummer, who sponsors our show called Upbeat, but I want to bring on like you and the people who I really love and admire, because you have so much wisdom. You've seen so much now that you are our history. What you've seen, what you do is really our history. And we can say it's all happened so quickly. The Beatles come in our lifetime. We heard Little Richard when we were kids. We've seen Ray Charles. These people are history. We know, we've heard Louis Armstrong. They call him the father of jazz. That's our lifetime. You know James Jameson. That's our lifetime. So when you stop and think about it, we are the encyclopedias going forward for these kids. So anything that you want to say about that, because that's how I see you. You're our encyclopedia. You're our history teacher. You're the cat.
All I know is, man, we are right now, we're in a place where we have a chance to, you know, a lot of people are in confinement. A lot of people are worried. A lot of people don't know how to take advantage of this time, but I think it's really possible to really do some positive stuff right now. You know, and that, to me, that means like, I'm really taking advantage of being able to, you know, a lot of people have an iPhone, a lot of people have a computer. There's so much music you can make, and there's so many tools that are there for you to make music with and create. And just like everything else, and I've said this a million times, and it's never been more true, and I really, really believe in it right now, is that everything is a phase. everything is a phase. I'm a phase, you know, my life is a phase, your life is a phase. That little mistake that you made playing that fill, that's a phase, you know. Maybe phases can be long or short, you know, but whatever it is a phase. You know, your relationship with somebody, it's a phase. If you're lucky enough, it's a long phase, you know. This COVID thing is a phase, and it's going to be over. It's going to be over at some point. So once that point comes around where it is now in the rearview mirror, you want to be able to really look back at what you did during that time and go, yeah, I set myself up for some really good stuff, you know. I prepared for, I'm going to be ready for when this thing's over. I'm going to have something to say. My chops are going to be better, you know. My ears are going to be more open than ever before because I spent time like really checking stuff out. But listen to some recommendations about what to check out. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot. Now I'm ready to rock, you know.
Yeah. Well, Will, we love you. And thanks for your time today, your inspiration. And I hope all the young kids and all the people around the world will take time when this interview airs to check it out and listen to you and learn by you, because I'm telling you, the people you've been around and the air you've been able to breathe is rarefied. Rarefied.
But I'm a greedy man and I want some more.
And you're greedy.
I'm a greedy man.
And you're going to get some more.
I'm a greedy man.
And you're going to get some more.
People who don't. Your homework I'm done. Come on. Hey man, I can't wait till we play again.
Okay. Yeah.
And I love you so much. Thank you.
You too, brother. Thank you, Will. And Sandrine too. Okay.
Now it's time for the Shop Talk section of the episode. This is Mike Dawson, Managing Editor at Modern Drummer. And this week we're going to continue checking out these Doc Sweeney Pure Series snare drums. Last episode, I dropped in the video for the Pure Elm. I feel like I should go ahead and share the others too. So this week we're going to talk about the Pure Oak. So these are all 5.5x14. The Pure Series are all 5.5x14 solid shell snares. There's three of them. There's Ash, there's Oak, and there's Elm. They are... like I said, solid shell, steam bent shell. They really are designed to just accentuate the purest, that's why they're called pure, sound of the wood. So there's very little done to the wood that would affect the sound. It's a natural finish, classic single point contact lug, so minimal, you know, effect to the shell itself. The reinforcement rings are actually shaped into the shell, so they're milled into the wood rather than being another piece of wood that's glued in, which also helps accentuate the tone. So these are really, really amazing drums. The Elm was the one I featured last week, so that was the most unique. The one that I think you should definitely take a look at if you're looking for a pretty much a flawless studio or live drum. It's the Oak. It has a slightly drier sound than the others, and it has a little bit more crack to the attack. It sounded really nice tuned low. The overtones, it was dry, so the overtones kind of, you know, cut themselves off naturally. I didn't need to use any, you know, a ton of muffling or anything like that. So this is one that I really think you should check out. If you haven't checked out Oak drums, this would be one of the finest examples of an Oak drum. So here it is. This is the Doc Sweeney Pure Series 5.5x14 Oak Series snare.
thank you, everybody, for watching this week's Modern Drummer Podcast. Stay tuned for next week's episode exclusively on Podcast One. Until then, stay safe and healthy, and thanks for listening and watching.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Chapter 1. Wayfair welcomes you to the neighborhood. Our hero, Titus Burgess, ambled down the stylish street of an enchanting utopia. A woman waved from a chic lounger. "Welcome to the neighborhood," she said, "where Wayfair helps everyone create a home they love." Titus stared in awe. Bohemian Boulevard, Trendsetter Terrace, Mid-Century Circle.
Titus.
Hmm?
You're reading the Wayfair catalog.
Oh, you'll love Chapter 2. Wayfair's fast and free shipping saves a potluck.
Wayfair, every style, every home.